This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I hope you're enjoying this Memorial Day. This year, the day also happens to fall on the birthday of an American veteran, president, and icon, John F. Kennedy. JFK was born 100 years ago today in Brookline, Massachusetts. 43 years later, he became the youngest person elected to the presidency of the United States.
The torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
That's from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, delivered on January 20th, 1961.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Kennedy did not complete his term in office, of course. He was assassinated during a re-election campaign trip to Dallas, Texas, on November 22, 1963. His death shocked the nation, and it amplified the already turbulent 1960s. It dimmed the faith that many had placed in Kennedy, that the young president might be able to change America's course on war in Vietnam, on civil rights, and on the Cold War. But in thinking of JFK, I sometimes think of what one insightful observer once wrote about Princess Diana, another political icon cut down in her prime. That observer wrote of the cleansing tragedy of death, that a generation of mourners would remember Diana, as they did JFK, in the light of selfless perfection. When myth replaces the man, we choose not to remember the affairs, the illnesses, the naked ambition, and the lies. But in recent years, that's been changing. The truth about JFK, the man, is now complementing popular memories of Kennedy as an icon. And it's given us a much more authentic, complex, human picture of one of America's most famous presidents. This hour, we're going to listen back to conversations we've had that explore that more complex view of John F. Kennedy, beginning with a 2011 conversation Anthony Brooks had with Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball. Matthews had just written a book on JFK called Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Matthews began by telling Anthony a story about one of Kennedy's friends.
It was a guy named Dick Kersey. He's a fellow naval officer in the South Pacific over in the Solomons. He said, I don't want to talk about Kennedy's politics, but I can say he was a good PT boat captain, and he was great company. Hmm. And he talked about Kennedy being a guy that could listen, who could laugh, who could enjoy your company, and he could give you a good story.
The sense that I get from Jack Kennedy in reading your book is this guy with this insatiable intellectual curiosity. I mean, and it was demonstrated early on in his life, wasn't it?
Well, reading the story of a kid who's 14 years old and very sick all the time with unknown diseases, that was the part that really captured him. He never knew what they were talking about. Hmm. But he had read The History of World War One, The World Crisis by Winston Churchill, who, of course, was first Lord of the Admiralty in World War One. And he'd read that at the age of 14. He was reading The New York Times. He would read it every day. And Rip Horton, one of his roommates, said he would lie on his bed and sort of try to distill what he learned in the article as an exercise, lie and think, now, what did I learn from that piece today? He was trying to teach himself to be something. I'm not sure an electoral politician, but a guy who was really focused on politics.
Hmm. You write that a half a century of political life later, referring to yourself, my fascination with the elusive spirit of JFK has remained an abiding one. He is both a pathfinder and puzzle, a beacon and a conundrum. In what way was he elusive?
Jacqueline Kennedy used that word. She said in a letter to Ted Sorensen about 85, She had just heard Sorensen's speech at the unveiling of Jack Kennedy's portrait at the National Portrait Gallery, where he talked about him being a guy who did good things and met his responsibilities to society and to his country, but also enjoyed life and enjoyed what he did. In other words, he had fun. And she said, "You've got him. You've figured out my Jack. And you've figured out my unforgettable, elusive man." And to her, he was elusive because he lived life in compartments. There was one compartment for her, and they had a marriage. And he also had these other women relationships, which are sometimes trivial and sometimes real. He had real romances throughout his life with different women. And then he had the Irish Mafia, who were his political confederates. He had a great time with them. They were tough guys. And anyway, Jack was living in these compartments, almost like the Titanic. Everything was a sealed-off compartment.
Right. You know, as I read your book, and I think you actually raised this point, but I certainly absorbed it if you didn't say it explicitly. You know, he is the son of privilege. Obviously, Joe Kennedy had tons and tons of money. It was always behind him in many ways. But in many ways, he was self-made. I mean, that's sort of one of the
points. He was a Gatsby. Yeah, he was a Gatsby. He was a guy who, although he was his father's son when it came to women, and I do not mean that as a courtesy or as a positive statement about him. He did have the attitude towards women, his father. Mm. And it wasn't a good attitude. And it's not only by contemporary standards, but by any standards. But he really was his own man in terms of his own person, in terms of he really opposed the old man on his anti-Semitism, his terribly chauvinistic view about America and money. Jack wanted to, he supported the Marshall Plan enthusiastically. The old man wanted Western Europe to fall to the Soviets, to Stalin. The old man just didn't. He was like a Daddy Warbucks character. He wasn't a good guy by today's standards. And Jack was ahead of his time. He was just a good guy. I have not found in all the reading of him any ethnic prejudice, no negativity. And he was, in that sense, very much like Tip O'Neill, I worked for all those years. I was in the back room with Tip. He never, ever said anything that was wrong about people.
Interesting.
Ever. And for his generation to be that positive, it was just a statement of a true liberal, a good liberal.
Chris Matthews, you mentioned Tip O'Neill, for whom you worked, and I'm really interested in what his response was to Jack Kennedy when Jack Kennedy came on the scene, because in many ways they came from such different worlds. What did he tell you?
I wouldn't say that the speaker understood immediately the appeal of Jack Kennedy any more than he understood the appeal of Ronald Reagan initially. He saw Jack as a rich kid, a skinny, he used to say skinny, pasty face, because he came out of the war in such terrible shape. And also, Tip was an old school guy who had worked his way up through the vineyards. He always said, you can't run for Congress till you've run for the great and general court. You had to serve in the assembly first and then maybe state senator and then worked your way up. And here's Jack coming back from the war. He was very much like a young Lindbergh. He looked like that, American hero.
And he was a genuine war hero, right? I mean, he was
for real. I mean, he wasn't some guy that was captured or had a tough time. He was a guy that stuck his neck out. His crew was drowning in that ocean in the South Pacific when that PT boat of his was cut in half, and he went out and swam through the gasoline-burning water, and he was the one that saved a couple guys who were way off in the boat, the part of the boat that had sank, and he carried them back. They were 4 miles from shore, and he had one guy, Pappy McMahon, who was badly burned. His engineer, he's 42 years old. He was older than the other guys. Jack threw him on his back, pulled out a knife and cut the guy's strap of his life jacket, put the strap in his teeth, and towed the guy by his teeth for 4 miles of water. I mean, he had to really swim pulling that guy. And the guy had no idea how bad a shape Jack was in. He never complained about this, never bragged about it. He was a great World War II kind of guy. Never complained, never explained. Mm. There was a lot about him.
Let's talk about the defining crisis in his presidency, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Here's President Kennedy addressing the nation after his administration discovers that the Soviets are installing what are essentially medium-range missiles on Cuba capable of hitting the U.S. with nuclear warheads. Let's listen.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
So, Chris, obviously, huge crisis of that time. Tell us what kind of pressure JFK was under to respond to those missiles more forcefully.
He had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the other members of the Joint Chiefs, like LeMay, Curtis LeMay, who had basically leveled Japan at the end of the war and basically ended the war. He had him calling for basically a strike on the missile bases. He had everybody put Dean Acheson, the great Cold War veteran from the Truman administration, all saying strike. His concern was that Khrushchev had warned him that if we struck Cuba, he would strike Berlin. And then Kennedy would have had to go to first use or else give up West Berlin, which would have been a horrendous message to our European allies if we gave up Berlin. Look, what we've learned since is that Khrushchev said in his memoirs that if we had attacked those bases, he had intermediate range missiles, not just medium range, and he could have hit New York. And he said, if I'd only had a couple of missiles left, I was going to hit New York. And I wouldn't kill everybody in New York, but I'd kill millions of people. Now, that was immature or naive, because how could he not have known that if he had struck New York from Cuba with nuclear missiles and killed millions of New Yorkers, that Kennedy would be forced to hit the Soviet Union in almost a first strike kind of scenario? He'd have to go for it. So, I mean, this horror, this thing is so hard to talk about because it was so close. All we needed was a more of a hot hand president at the time, a Nixon, a little hotter head who'd said, wait, we're not going to take this.
Would have had
we're going to show them.
A very, very different outcome.
Just a foot from us, this almost happened.
Well, related to this in the book, and this is sort of where you end or close to the end, you write about the speech that he gave at the American University in June of 1963, the so-called peace speech. And we've got a brief clip. I want to just play
it's
it right
his
here.
Best speech.
Here we go.
As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war.
And Chris, he goes on to say, in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. Amazing words from the hard-nosed cold warrior at one point.
Yeah, it was such an evolution on his part.
It really was, wasn't it? I'm wondering how that speech was received by the Soviets.
Well, they liked it so much that Khrushchev put it on Soviet television, which had never happened before. It was the first time we ever said, yeah, you guys are unbelievable what you were able to do with the Red Army against the Wehrmacht, what you pulled off. I don't know what would have happened if Kennedy had survived Dallas, but I think the older I get, the more I think, boy, you know, he had the right goals. He was the one, you know, watch a football game in Ole Miss today or watch the Crimson Tide, Alabama, and there are some black players, and maybe mostly black players in some of the teams, but there were no blacks allowed to go to those schools. Before Kennedy basically in 1962 and 63 said, it's over. No more Jim Crow, no more segregation. It's over. He was the guy that brought federal troops into Mississippi and opened up Ole Miss by force of arms. I mean, he did it. I mean, people that say he didn't get everything done, no, he didn't. But he began us on the course of winning the Cold War without war, which we ended up doing. And he thought he could do it through a technological display of our system being better, which is the space program. We could prove we are better than the Soviets by beating them to the moon. And I was in the Peace Corps at the time we went to the moon, and I remember one of my Peace Corps fellow volunteers took his people out onto a hillside and pointed to the light crossing the horizon. And he said, look at that. And he was teaching the people he was teaching, you know, this are my countrymen going to the moon. It's pretty impressive stuff.
MSNBC's Chris Matthews. His book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. And he spoke with Anthony Brooks in 2011. Coming up, secret Oval Office tapes take us inside the Kennedy White House. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're observing the centennial of President John F. Kennedy's birth today. Before the break, we heard MSNBC's Chris Matthews talk about Kennedy the man. Now, what about Kennedy the politician? He was an ambitious president. Consider his call for a moonshot or the way he confronted the Cuban Missile Crisis. But he also fell short of that ambition on critical issues facing 1960s America, most notably civil rights. On August 28, 1963, President Kennedy was at the White House, and like many other Americans on that day, he watched the historic March on Washington on television. And when the march finished, President Kennedy picked up the phone and invited Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders to the Oval Office. He wanted to congratulate them on their success. But earlier that same summer, President Kennedy had urged civil rights leaders to call off the march, as he worried that the presence of hundreds of thousands of protesters on the National Mall could jeopardize his own early efforts to pass the Civil Rights Act.
But once they went ahead, and he watched it on television and saw how effective it was and how effective Martin Luther King's speech was, and that the whole thing was carried off with no violence at all, it changed the way in which he responded to it. And it gave him some increased hope that the bill might pass.
That's Robert Dalek speaking to us in 2013. Dalek is professor emeritus at Boston University and one of the nation's preeminent presidential historians. He's author of many books on Kennedy, including An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. The evening of the march, civil rights leaders responded to Kennedy's request and did meet with him at the White House. There are recordings of that meeting, and in them you hear Roy Wilkins, executive secretary of the NAACP, telling Kennedy the people had spoken. It was time for the government to act.
People back home, from the small towns to big cities, the working people, men who gave up 2 days' pay, 3 days' pay, it means that they, and not Martin Luther King or Roy Wilkins or Whitney Young or Walter Luther, dreamed up this civil rights business. They feel it in their hearts enough to come here and show by their presence to you and to the Congress what they hope their government will do.
Now, this is where we get a glimpse of Kennedy's complicated, even ambiguous view of the civil rights movement. Kennedy makes it clear that he believes it's not just the government's responsibility to change American attitudes about race. Robert Dalek, in part of the tape, we hear President Kennedy himself. And there's a point in which they're discussing the question of education. And the president says, isn't it possible for the Negro community to take the lead in committing major emphasis upon the responsibility of black families, essentially, when it comes to education? And what I hear there is a glimpse into how the president, in part, wanted middle-class African-Americans to shoulder some of the responsibility to prove to the rest of the nation, to prove to white Americans that they weren't the enemy, necessarily.
Yeah, it's a very good point. The concern with education was reflected in the fact that, of course, Kennedy also had a bill before the Congress for federal aid to education. And he and Lyndon Johnson believed very much in the idea that if you could give blacks equal opportunity in the schools, they could participate in the economy in a much more competitive way. It was the oldest idea in America that the way to gain access to the middle class was through being serious about your education.
Let's kind of go back in time a little bit, because on June 22nd, you know, roughly 2 months before, he met with civil rights leaders in the White House, you know, and when they just after they had declared that they were going to march on the Capitol. And the president tells, you know, Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph that what they should be focusing on is, quote, success in Congress and not a big show on the Capitol. Looking back now, we know that the march was a peaceful event. But Kennedy at that time, in 63, had every reason to be worried, didn't he? I mean, the South was essentially exploding.
Yes, he did, because there had been so much violence across the South. In Alabama, the chief of police bringing out these snarling police dogs and those fire hoses that could rip the bark off a tree and turning them on these young people who were marching peacefully, that he had every reason to believe that this march could not be an entirely peaceful affair.
It's remarkable to think about how that summer was. The march happens on August 28th. You know, just 2 months before that, there's that meeting at the White House on June 22nd. And just 11 days before that, on June 11th, 1963, President Kennedy gives that incredible and now famous address where he first says that civil rights is a moral issue.
It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated.
And before that, privately, he said, you know, the Southerners tell us, stay out of it. We'll take care of it. In essence, states' rights. He said they keep saying that, but they never do anything. And they never will do anything unless we act now and we assert the authority of the federal government, was essentially what he was saying.
But on the other hand, he also mentions the fact that we were sending soldiers at that time into foreign wars.
We preach freedom around the world, and we mean it. And we cherish our freedom here at home. But are we to say to the world, and much more importantly, to each other, that this is a land of the free, except for the Negroes, that we have no second-class citizens, except Negroes, that we have no class or caste system, no ghettos, no master race, except with respect to Negroes.
So he gives a glimpse that, you know, his focus really was on foreign policy. Civil rights was a secondary issue that his hand was forced on to talk about at that time. And then at the same time, while he's giving this amazing speech saying we cannot fulfill the dream of America unless we bring about equality for all its citizens, he's also behind the scenes telling civil rights leaders to slow down. So was the president sort of talking out of both sides of his mouth?
Indeed, he would say, politics can unseat you, but foreign policy can kill you. And his highest priority was to avoid some kind of conflict with Russia, which would turn into a nuclear holocaust. So Kennedy is brought essentially kicking and screaming into the civil rights issue. You see, Kennedy's concern was not just with the question of equal possibility, equal opportunity, and of justice, but he was also concerned by the consideration that the Chinese and Soviet communists were beating unmercifully on the United States for being a racist society. And Kennedy was intensely concerned about the hearts and minds, as it was put, in the developing countries. And he felt that a step forward on civil rights was going to do a great deal to sell America's side of the Cold War. And he says, let's face up to it. You know, our record here is not one that we can be proud of.
We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right, that your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have, that the only way that they are going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that.
Professor Dalek, let me ask you about just the domestic politics that President Kennedy was also dealing with at the time. The 1960 election that he won was so very, very close. He needed every black vote that he could get, but he also needed those Southern Democrats who were the segregationists as well. I mean, was that part of what he was, you know, weighing and balancing in the summer of 63?
Without question. And that's why that the speech in behalf of civil rights on June 11, 63 can be seen as a courageous act on his part. They worried that they might be jeopardizing his reelection, and that's in significant part why he went to Texas in November of 63. It was a fence-mending trip.
And, of course, it's on November 22, 1963, in Dallas, where Kennedy is assassinated. You know, given that he never did have a chance to run for that second term, and it is Lyndon Johnson who ends up pushing through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, in the end, what would you say is President Kennedy's legacy on civil rights issues? Did he drag his feet for too long?
Well, I would say his legacy is somewhat mixed, but at the end of the day, he was courageous in finally putting that bill before the Congress. So there really is, on civil rights, it probably is best described as a Kennedy-Johnson act of law.
Robert Dalek is one of the nation's preeminent historians and author of many books, including An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, and Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. We spoke with him in 2013. Now, in that conversation, we heard recordings of President Kennedy's Oval Office meetings with civil rights leaders. And as Robert Dalek mentioned, much of the president's actions on civil rights can be viewed through the lens of the Cold War. Because just the year before, in October 1962, the world had trembled on the brink of nuclear war as it waited for 13 tense days for a resolution to the Cuban Missile Crisis. An American spy plane had photographed and confirmed Soviet nuclear installations in Cuba. And on October 16th, President John F. Kennedy called a secret meeting of military advisors in the Oval Office.
There's a medium-range ballistic missile launch site.
You're listening to a recording of that meeting.
On the southern edge in west central Cuba.
Who would that be?
CIA experts Arthur Lundahl and Sidney Graybeal are speaking to the president.
How far advanced is this?
Sir, we've never seen this kind of an installation before.
Even in the Soviet Union?
No, sir. From May of 69, we've never had any...
They'd never seen this kind of installation before. On October 18th, President Kennedy privately recorded this dictation.
Why? I was most anxious that we not have to announce a state of war existing, because it would obviously be bad to have the word go out, but
the Americans decided to blockade Cuba. No one knew how the Soviets would respond. On October 23rd, Kennedy makes a phone call to Assistant Secretary of Defense Roswell Gilpatrick.
In order to stop them, I thought that we were going to have to fire on them. I was wondering whether the instructions on how that's to be done, or where they're to be shot at and so on, to cause the minimum of damage, and in addition, if they're boarded, it's very possible the Russians will fire at them as they board, and we'd have to fire back and have quite a slaughter.
October 28th.
Yes, sir.
President Truman, please.
Thank you.
Kennedy calls the only man ever to have ordered the use of an atomic weapon, President Harry Truman.
He'll be with you in just 1 minute, Mr. President.
All right.
Hello.
Hello, this is Harry Truman.
Hello, how are you, Mr. President?
Well, I'm all right, and I'm just pleased to death the way these things came out.
Well, we just stay at it, and I just wanted to bring you up to date on it. We got a letter from him on Friday night, which... was rather conciliatory on these withdrawals. Then on Saturday morning, 12 hours after the other letters received, we got this entirely different letter about the missile bases in Turkey.
That's the way they do things. You're on the right track, and you just keep asking them. That's the language they understand, just what you give.
All right, good.
They've been asking me for comments, and I said the President of the United States, no man can comment on it.
All right. Okay, good. Take care. I'll be in touch with you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. President.
I certainly appreciate your call.
Oh, thank you, Mr. President.
The recordings are remarkable. Listening to them puts you right inside the Oval Office, witness to a political high-wire effort to avert nuclear catastrophe. And even more remarkable, the hours of recordings were secret. No one in the White House or on the other end of the phone knew that President Kennedy was making them. But in 2012, the JFK Presidential Library released hours of the historic audio along with the book Listening In, the secret White House recordings of John F. Kennedy. We talked with Tom Putnam, then the director of the library, and he told us that Kennedy started recording Oval Office conversations in the summer of 1962.
After the Bay of Pigs, different people, his advisors, said, well, I had said this and I gave this advice. And there was a sense that he wanted an accurate accounting so that he could hold people accountable to the advice they had given to him.
But they were secret tapes.
Yeah, the only people who knew about them were the Secret Service agent who installed them and his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, who occasionally was the person who pressed the button to start the tapes. And there's some question that even Attorney General Robert Kennedy didn't know the tapes until after his brother's death.
Oh, fascinating. I mean, the tapes offer huge insight into the workings of the Kennedy presidency, and there are hours and hours of recordings. What were some of the revelations that most surprised you?
What you see is a president totally in control. And so through these tapes, you see him in the center of action. You know, it's down to the details during the Cuban Missile Crisis when they're actually going to stop some of the Soviet ships. He asks, you know, we need to be sure, are there press on these ships? I mean, he's really thinking ahead about every little detail involved with the decisions he's making.
Well, regarding the Cuban Missile Crisis, there is a bit of tape of a phone call between President Kennedy and former President Dwight Eisenhower right at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
General, what about if the Soviet Union Khrushchev announces tomorrow, which I think he will, that if we attack Cuba, that it's going to be nuclear war. And what's your judgment as to the chances they'll fire these things off if we invade Cuba?
Oh, I don't believe it.
You don't think they will?
Matter of fact, what can you do? If this thing is such a serious thing here on our flank, that we're going to be uneasy, and we know what thing's happening now. All right, we got to use something. Right. Something may make these people shoot them off. I just don't believe this will.
Yeah. No, hang on tight.
Yes, sir.
Thanks a lot, General.
All right. Thanks.
Tom Putnam, to think back at how the world was feeling mm-hmm. at this moment, I mean, we felt like we were on the brink of nuclear war. And here we have two very powerful men talking to each other, both frankly and yet collegially. I mean, what do you make of it?
And that bit of dark humor when they're literally talking about perhaps a nuclear exchange and, you know, hold on tight. Eisenhower's advice is in keeping with the advice that JFK got from most of his military advisors, which is go ahead and invade. And really, I think President Kennedy had the longer view. I think he loved history. He understood that he owed it to history to do everything he could to avoid any incidents that could lead to a nuclear exchange. And as we know, that's the way he resolved the crisis.
Interesting, because President Kennedy wasn't just a historian or a strategist. He was also a president and therefore a politician. So yes. He was very sensitive to how things looked, and not right. only to the American people, but to folks that he had to deal with on Capitol Hill, for example.
Yeah.
And we've got some tape here of a moment where Kennedy opens the paper one day in 1963, I believe, and is pretty upset by what he reads, that military aides have built a hospital bedroom for a then pregnant Jackie just in case she went into labor. So let's listen to that.
Spend $5,000 for that. Let's cut their budget another $100
million. Precisely, Mr. President. The last word that they had for me yesterday after my talk to Pierre was, keep the photographers out of there and fight them out of there.
Okay.
They went ahead on their own. The funny part about this is that it's a sidelight, which might lighten your day, is that the Army, you know, when we saved from this sort of thing out Walter Reed, when they saw this yesterday, they're unhappy, if you please.
Well, that's why the goddamn series, they ought to cut them $1 billion.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, when you think of what the waste was on.
It is, absolute nonsense.
Imagine what they'd do if you didn't just stay on their ass. They were going to order me three planes instead of one.
Precisely.
It would seem to me, I'd like to send that furniture back. Have they paid for it?
I'll find out.
Just in my own. I don't care. We own a store, but I'd just like to send that goddamn furniture back. It's probably worth about $1,500, $2,000.
When I asked him yesterday, where did the $5,000 go?
Yeah.
One of the things they told me, I said, well, you couldn't have possibly spent $5,000 on that.
A lot of the stuff we can just ship right back today.
Right. I'll get ready.
I'd love to send it right back to Jordan Marsh in an Air Force truck this afternoon with that captain on it. Now, what about transferring his ass out of here in about a month? He doesn't have any sense. For incompetence, not for screwing us.
Exactly. Well,
and that silly fellow who had his picture taken next to the bed, I'd have him go up to Alaska, too. The PA will be talking to you about that.
Right.
Okay.
This is not a warm and fuzzy John Kennedy.
No,
I mean,
no.
He wants to ship people out to Alaska. What's going on here?
Well, it's amazing the amount of money. I mean, $5,000, such a drop in the bucket. But as you said, he was concerned about public relations. Why would people be spending this money? There's an interesting story that the gentleman who he calls the silly bastard, who had his picture taken next to the bed, is still alive, and he never did get shipped up to Alaska. As a matter of fact, it was until he heard this tape he never knew that the president had seen his photo and was that upset about it.
These tapes are so amazing. You feel like you're right there.
Yeah, well, that's what we hope. I mean, it really allows you to relive the Kennedy presidency, and we want people to really be able to feel like they were in the Oval Office and experience it the way President Kennedy did.
In this day and age, it's almost hard to imagine that a president would want so much of his private moments actually captured for history. I mean, what does it tell you that, or do you imagine such a thing being able to happen now?
Well, after Watergate, I think every president learned that you can get burned as much by tapes as like these as they can shed a positive light on you. Many historians say their respect for John F. Kennedy grows the more they listen to these tapes. When you hear him, you see the decisions that he's making. He had a lot of resolve, but he also had a degree of caution, especially during things like the Cuban Missile Crisis and advancing civil rights. But I think it also shows a level of confidence that he had in himself and the decisions that he was making.
Tom Putnam, former director of the JFK Presidential Library. He spoke with us in 2012. So President Kennedy certainly had confidence in his decision-making, as Tom Putnam described. That confidence was frequently on display in his speeches. For example, here's Kennedy speaking to a joint session of Congress on May 25th, 1961.
These are extraordinary times, and we face an extraordinary challenge. Our strength, as well as our convictions, have imposed upon this nation the role of leader in freedom's cause. No role in history could be more difficult or more important.
America should be a leader and an example for the nations of the world struggling against tyranny and exploitation, Kennedy said.
Finally, if we are to win the battle that is now going on around the world between freedom and tyranny, the dramatic achievements in space which occurred in recent weeks should have made clear to us all, as did the Sputnik in 1957, the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take.
Kennedy was talking about the fact that just 1 month earlier, on April 12, 1961, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin successfully orbited the Earth, the first human in space. So Kennedy challenged Congress to achieve an even greater goal.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Kennedy struck a confident tone to Congress, but that tone belies serious reservations the president had about the American space program, both at the time and even a full year later. That is from a 1963 White House recording made public by the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in 2011. Kennedy is speaking to then NASA Administrator James Webb. The president seems to be seeking affirmation, even support, for what he's asking the nation to undertake. He asks James Webb, "If I get reelected, we're not going to the moon in our period, are we?" Webb responds, "No." But goes on to say this.
But I'll tell you what will be accomplished by your president, and it'll be one of the most important things that's been done in this nation. A basic means to use technology for total national power.
Total national power, Kennedy notes, in the midst of the Cold War.
Well, it seems to me what we've got to try to do is suggest that we've got to wrap around in this country a military use for what we're doing and spending in space.
Kennedy asks Webb whether the mission can be done cheaper. No, Webb says, but he assures the president that manned space exploration must be part of America's future. Kennedy agrees.
Yeah, I think this can be an asset, this program. I think in time it's like a lot of things. It's sort of mid-journey, and therefore everybody says, what the hell are we making this trip for?
That's right.
But at the end of the thing, they may be glad we made it.
And the nation was glad they made it, which the United States did, when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon July 20th, 1969.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
President John F. Kennedy speaking at Rice University in 1962. We'll be back. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty.
Now the messages are beginning to come in from around the world
and from the cities of the United States, where a nation is in almost, I would say it advisedly, almost uncontrollable shock, it seems. They're weeping on the streets.
CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite on November 22, 1963, just 2 hours after President John F. Kennedy was pronounced dead in Dallas. And those messages, they continued to pour in, especially letters written to First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy, more than 1.5 million letters overall. Historian Ellen Fitzpatrick looked at thousands of those letters housed at the JFK Presidential Library, and she winnowed the collection down to about 200 and published them in a book, Letters to Jackie. Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks spoke with Fitzpatrick in 2013 on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, and Fitzpatrick told us just how deeply that grief was felt by average Americans in 1963.
The way in which that event reverberated into the lives of individual Americans, people really felt that their own lives had been changed as profoundly as if a member of their own family had died.
Well, give us an example of that. I know you've brought the book in. I can imagine out of 200 letters that you culled, it must be hard to say what is your favorite, but pick one out that is at least in your top 10.
Dear Mrs. Kennedy, I wish to extend to you and the children my condolences. Children increase the cares of life, but they do help to mitigate the remembrance of death. We are told that a good key is necessary to enter paradise. The president, following the guidelines of his church, possessed this key. Heaven, it seems, calls its favorites early. In the president, I felt I had known a whole man. It is a rare experience, but always an illuminating and ennobling one. It costs so much to be a full human being that there are very few who have the enlightenment or the courage to pay the price. The lights of the prison have gone out now. In this, the quiet time, I can't help but feel that my thoughts and the thoughts of my countrymen will ever reach out to that light on an Arlington hillside for sustenance. How far that little light throws his beam. Sincerely, Stephen J. Hanrahan, 85255, Federal Penitentiary, Atlanta, Georgia.
Wow. That is something.
It's a beautiful letter.
Yeah, it is really something. I want to play a piece of tape. This is from Jacqueline Kennedy. January 14th, 1964, less than 2 months after the assassination, she appears on national TV in her first public statement since her husband's death to essentially thank the nation for this extraordinary group of letters that she's been receiving.
The knowledge of the affection in which my husband was held by all of you has sustained me. And the warmth of these tributes is something I shall never forget. Whenever I can bear to, I read them. All his bright light gone from the world. All of you who have written to me know how much we all loved him and that he returned that love in full measure.
So that's Jacqueline Kennedy appearing on national TV January 14th, 1964. Ellen, she promises to respond to all of them. Obviously, she didn't do it personally, but she did make an effort, right, to respond to each and every one.
She did. And there was a black-bordered card printed up that had a simple message that Mrs. Kennedy thanks you for your expression of sympathy, and a staff of many thousands of volunteers over a period of several years devoted themselves to answering those letters. When I began research on the book and I needed to locate the letter writers or their next of kin, I found that many families had saved those cards, and it meant a great deal to people, as I'm sure she knew it would, to have that thank you.
I'm curious. Many of the letters sort of reference this idea that so many Americans connected the president's death to social and political upheaval in the country at the time, specifically around civil rights.
That's right. There was a great sense of, among some letter writers, of guilt and responsibility, the belief that a climate of violence and political extremism that many Americans felt existed in the country had claimed the president. Mm. There was an amazing letter from one woman, for example, who said, The reason that all men mourn the death of your husband is because we feel we have played a part in his murder.
Mm.
We may not have been there or even known that you were there, but we were all responsible because we did not fight with him in everything he stood for. We just sat back and watched. We have wasted a great man. We may not realize that fault now, but in time, history will write its own story on blood-filled pages.
Oh, boy. You know, it's interesting because I think all of us who are old enough to remember, I think my recollection, I mean, I was so young, I was 5 or 6 at the time, but I think it's the first time I saw adults in my life cry, and I didn't really understand what it was about, but the memory remains.
I think that was a common response, and there was a wonderful letter in the collection from a young schoolgirl who talked about hearing the news in school but not believing it, not wanting to believe it. Mm. And she said that she came home and she saw her mother, and she said, and her eyes had truth in them.
Oh, boy.
I certainly remember vividly my own parents being terribly distraught.
Before we go, I'd love you to read for maybe just the final seconds here one last letter from your collection.
I will read a letter from a man who was writing on November 28th of 1963. My dear Mrs. Kennedy, I could not let this week come full circle without expressing deepest sympathy in the great loss of your beloved husband and our beloved president. Truly, the whole world mourns his passing. The impact is everywhere. You drive down country lanes, on off-the-beaten-track roads, and outside of house after house, there is the flag of our country fluttering at half-mast. Fellow citizens mourning outside their homes as well as in their hearts. It tugs at the throat, but you go on, only to have the next friend encountered inquire, "Have you noticed that the ache keeps coming back again and again?" It does, of course. It is a precious thing, this grief he leaves us, for the sorrow now would not be so deep if the joy and pride in him and you had not been so high.
Ellen Fitzpatrick is professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. She's reading a letter there from her book, Letters to Jackie. She spoke with us in 2013. Well, let's end this special hour listening back to John F. Kennedy himself. This is from his New Frontiers speech, given July 15th, 1960.
All mankind waits upon our decision. A whole world looks to see what we shall do. And we cannot fail that trust, and we cannot fail to try. It has been a long road from the first snowy day in New Hampshire many months ago to this crowded convention city. Now begins another long journey, taking me into your cities and homes across the United States. Give me your help and your hand and your voice. Recall with me the words of Isaiah, that they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. As we face the coming great challenge, we too shall wait upon the Lord and ask that he renew our strength. Then shall we be equal to the test. Then we shall not be weary. Then we shall prevail.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.